Well, good morning. Glad everybody made it here this morning, despite the time change. I forgot about the time change, but you know, cell phones change automatically, so that was fine. But I was like, man, why am I so tired? Like, because it was, you know, it's like 6:30. I'm like, I'm normally up and doing well, you know, earlier than this. And then Beth reminded me about the time change. I'm like, oh, so it's like 5:30 in the morning right now. All right. So anyway, glad you all made it here. Hopefully you're awake and alert. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for the morning you've given us. Thank you for the opportunity to look into your word. And God, we pray that we would grow in our knowledge of you, our love of you today, that as we worship you together in the hour ahead, that we would worship in spirit and in truth, God, and that you would be made much of in our own hearts, as well as we sing praises to you, that we would encourage one another with these songs and hymns and spiritual songs. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so you have a handout if that's helpful. There's still some on the back. Music stand if you need one. Let me set the scene here. It's always good to do a little bit of review. Hopefully it doesn't weary you, but I think it's good to be reminded. Several chapters earlier, Jacob had received the promised blessings, right? So God had been promising, even from Genesis chapter 3, that there's going to be salvation coming through this offspring because sin had entered the world. And so there was this promise. Small problem, though, for Jacob, right? He had lied to his father to steal the blessing, right? And his brother Esau, whom he had in many ways really, humanly speaking, stolen the blessing from, although God had already said he was going to give it to Jacob. But remember, Jacob went about it in a way that he was essentially stealing it, right? So tensions are not, you know, are high in Isaac's house. Isaac is Jacob's father, remember that? And so he has to basically go into some sort of exile because his brother wants to murder him, right? So that was kind of what happened earlier. So on his way out of the promised land, fleeing into exile, so he has this experience in Genesis 28. So I'm going to read from Genesis 28. If you want to look there, you can. I may not necessarily read every verse here, but I'm going to skip through some of them. Genesis 28, beginning in the second part of verse 13, God appears to him as he's in this place called Bethel, and God says, well, it's not called Bethel yet. He's going to call it Bethel in a minute. And God says, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. So remember, you have Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob. That's the lineage there, right? The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. And then he goes on and makes more of a promise about the offspring and the extent of the land that he'll possess. And in verse 15, he says, behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised. So God makes these promises. He affirms that he's going to bless him. He's going to keep him. And so then in verse 16, Jacob awakes from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Skipping down a little bit further in verse 19, he called the name of the place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. So Jacob makes a vow. Is this a conditional vow? Does he put conditions on it? Yeah, he definitely does, right? So at this point, he's not even saying this is my God, right? He's just saying, if the God of my fathers does this for me, he'll be my God at that point, right? So very weak faith. In fact, I don't think he's a believer at this point, but obviously he does know something about God. God's made himself known to Jacob. And he makes this promise, and he's going to come back to this place called Bethel. He's saying, God, if you bring me back to this place, I'm going to worship you. And God had said, I will be with you. I'm going to go with you. I'm going to bring you back to this place. So that was all happening, right? I'm going to bring you back here. Jacob says, great, you bring me back here. I worship you. Now, I will say, I think Bobby, I listened to you at on my thing, because I was teaching the membership class, and they're doing their last session this morning, but I was in there. And so I decided to listen to it because it's probably good to know what happens, right? Before the chapter you're in, right? I think that's, you see something of Jacob's conversion probably in what you looked at last week, I think that's when he becomes converted. But Bobby pointed this out, and it's important to realize, is Jacob, well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Let me back up just a bit here. So he knows all these things. If you fast forward 20 years from what I just read, a couple pages in your Bible, but 20 years further into the future, the Lord has blessed him, right? With he gave him children, the offspring that he promised, I'm going to start making your descendants numerous, many material blessings. He left with nothing. He's coming back with all sorts of wealth in terms of cattle and sheep and all these other things. I don't know if he had cattle, but he had a lot of sheep, goats, things like that, okay? So all this is happening. And in Genesis 31:13, he says, this is before he leaves. He's still back where he's got all this stuff, but his greedy father-in-law will not let him go back to the promised land that God had said, I'll bring you back to this land. So God appears to Jacob again in chapter 31, verse 13, and says, I am the God of Bethel. Remember, we just saw that place, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. So God specifically reappears to him and says, okay, it's time for you to go back to Bethel, and I've kept you, I will keep you the rest of the way, and so I want you to go fulfill your vow at Bethel. And then in verses 18 through 20 of chapter 33, this is how it ended last time. This is where Bobby was in this chapter last time. It says, and Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem. So he's re-entered into the area of Canaan, but is Shechem Bethel? No, right? Okay, so even in English we can tell that, right? You don't have to know Hebrew to figure that out, right? Shechem is not Bethel. Okay, which is the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram. And he camped before the city, and from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. There he erected an altar and called it El Elohi Israel. So, the question is he in Bethel? No. He did erect an altar, but he's not back where God said he would ultimately end up yet. The important thing to realize is he's coming back, but he's not back to where God had promised him he'd bring him, and he hasn't done the fulfillment of what he told God he would do yet, okay? That's where we leave off. So all that sets the scene for what's going to happen today, because they're in a place where things are going to go badly for them. There's about to be a significant tragedy all around. What's going to happen is one of Jacob's daughters, and we only have one daughter mentioned earlier in the whole birth narrative where they're going through all the birth of all the children that's happening. I think there probably were other daughters. There's another passage later that tells us something about his daughters. So I think there were more daughters. The only one that gets mentioned is Dinah, and I think it's because of what happens to her in this chapter. She's about to get raped by Shechem, who is the second in command of this city, basically. And then his two sons, two of Jacob's sons, Dinah's brothers, are going to orchestrate mass murder in the city. They're going to go seek vengeance and wipe out all the men of the city. And then the rest of the sons who don't participate directly in the murder, they all come, Jacob's sons, and they plunder the city. Okay? So the question before we jump into all this is, why are such horrific events recorded in the Bible? Because, I mean, this is things that happen here are horrifying. So why is it recorded? Well, because it happened. Right? That's true. But that doesn't really answer the question, because there are lots of things that happened that don't get recorded. I mean, you don't have a minute by minute, second by second, play by play of Jacob's life, right? So what's the reason this gets included? And you always have to be careful when you ask that question. You want to look and see context and why, because you want to get the Bible to tell you why, and it doesn't necessarily directly answer that question. So you have to be careful. But I think it's worth asking, because by answering that, we're saying, why is it important? Why does it matter? Why should we spend time studying this chapter of the Bible? Because, I mean, you know, honestly, when you read it, you kind of would rather just skip over it. I mean, you read it, and it's just horrifying what's happening in this chapter. But it did happen, so that's one reason it's in here. For the initial Israelites, so not the events recorded, but when is it recorded? When is this written down? Where are the Israelites at when they receive this? Does anyone know? Who's the author of Genesis? You could say God, that's true. Who's the person God worked through? Moses. Okay, what does Moses do for the people of Israel? He leads them out of Egypt, right? They get enslaved in Egypt. He leads them out. There's this Exodus, which, by the way, is a huge event in the Bible. That really sets up the scene for God's redemptive displays throughout the rest of the Bible. But we'll leave that for another day. So he sets up this, Moses has him, and do you know where Israel's at when they're probably receiving these books, these first five books of the Bible? They're like, so they've been wandering, they're getting ready to go into the land, but they've been wandering in the wilderness. So they're getting ready to go into the promised land, this land that we're reading about now that they are currently not in. But they know God said, this is for you, right? Jacob, Israel, right? Jacob gets renamed Israel. Remember that from last? So his descendants are the ones that we're talking about are wandering when they receive this. So I think some of it is some of the things we're having in Genesis are recorded to prepare them for that. That's really a lot of it. They're being reminded here of the dangers of intermarrying or any sort of real relationship with the Canaanites. They're going to see the deceptiveness of the Canaanites, the danger of making any sort of connection with them. They're just being reminded of things like that, I think, because Israel is tempted to make connections with the Canaanites rather than do what God says, which God says he's going to use them as an instrument to judge the Canaanites, okay? Now, I don't think they should reading this and thinking what these guys did was right, the Jacob's sons did was right when they attacked this city. I don't think that's the case because they didn't have a direct command from God to do that. They weren't being used as an instrument of judgment. And by the way, just so you know, later on in history, God uses pagan nations to as an instrument of judgment against Israel, right? So God does that or did that in the Old Testament times. So we have this tragedy then that gets recorded, and I think for us then, so what's the purpose for us? Because we're not necessarily about to enter the promised land. I think we should understand it in terms of what God's teaching Israel, but there's also a bigger picture now that we have the more full narrative. Because, you know, God is the one who authored all Scripture. So he has this immediate application, but as you situate it in the bigger storyline that God continued to write, right, it does not do justice to a passage in the Old Testament to stop there and just say, well, we can only know what Israel would have known at that time, because that's not reality for you and me. You see what I'm saying? The storyline continued. There's more to it now. And so how does it fit now in the broader context of the Bible? Well, I think it's this picture of, in God's plan of redemption, his promises will not be thwarted by evil people who have no fear of God, like the Shechemites, the people living in Shechem. It will not be thwarted by deception, because people are deceptive. And you think, what could undermine promises that God gives? Well, deception could do that. But we're going to see here, no, that's not going to undermine God's promises. Violence that people participate in. People can rage, they can push back, they can do all these things, but nothing is going to thwart God's plan of redemption and ultimately culminating in Jesus coming and then for us, his return. Okay? So we ought to be encouraged that God rules and overrules all things in history to bring about his purposes. So let's look, you have an outline in front of you, so I won't necessarily read all those headings for you at this point, but you can see that where we're going with it. So the first section is going to be Shechem's evil violence. So let me read beginning in verse 1 of chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl for my wife." Okay, so let's walk through this real quick. Dinah, who's her mother? Okay, and what? So this brings us back to something that happened earlier in the storyline. What? Tell us about the messed up family dynamics of Jacob. He has two wives. Problem, right? And then he also, in that, shows favoritism. He loves Rachel, and he does not love Leah. Leah. I keep saying Leah like Princess Leah. Leah, right? Okay. He doesn't love Leah. So we're being reminded right off the bat here, the person that ends up in this situation is the daughter of the unloved wife, okay? From the very beginning. So that just calls to mind, this is already a messed up situation from the beginning, and I think it's going to explain something too of probably Jacob's ongoing just passiveness in all of his family relationships that we've seen earlier. Because we're going to see that he's just real passive in this whole narrative. He doesn't do anything. Okay. So she goes out to see the women of the land. Perhaps she's just curious about them. Perhaps she's seeking some sort of popularity. Maybe they had some sort of makeup product she wanted. I don't know. For some reason, she goes to visit these people. I don't think, let's just be clear about this. Leah is not to be blamed for what happens to her, right? I mean, who's the guilty party? Shechem. He is an evil man. But, you know, what we've seen earlier in Genesis is the women of the land, in other words, the Canaanites, are not ones that Abraham and his descendants are to intermingle with because they're still worshiping false gods, right? Because you see it earlier, like whenever their sons, they want to marry them off. And like Abraham says about his son, he's like, I don't want him to marry from one of the women of the land because they're just worshiping idols. So and there's no sort of family connection that they have, I guess. So there's probably multiple reasons they don't do that. But the point is, Genesis does set us up to realize intermingling is not a great idea for Abraham's descendants. And so we see that happening here. Maybe she wants to find a husband. We have no idea what the reason is. But again, nothing justifies what happens, what Shechem does, because Shechem rapes Dinah. Here's this woman, and she is vulnerable. She's a foreign woman. He seizes her. He forces himself on her, and he humiliates her. He dishonors her. So he is a what we would call a sexual predator. I think that's a fair way to refer to Shechem. He is not a good guy. His own desires and wants seem to be ultimate. Now, you might be thinking, okay, well, what's verse 3 all about? Because verse 3, he says, you know, he said he loves her, and then he talks tenderly to her after all this whole thing. What's that all about? Okay, well, I think we can be pretty clear by the verse before that, that whatever, no matter what he's calling this feeling he's having, right? Now, people are very self-deceived. I have no doubt that he really thinks he loves her, right? But from his actions, it's very clear he loves one person. Who's that one person? Himself, right? And it becomes even more clear, it becomes just as clear in the next verse, because in verse 4, how does he talk to his dad? Get me this girl, right? This is not love. This is not what the Bible would define as love. Let's put it that way. And so we ought to realize that. People can throw around the word love and it can mean all sorts of things, but the question is, what does the love look like? That's how we determine, is it actually love or not? And the New Testament gives us some pretty clear indications on what love looks like, right? Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not insist on its own way. That would be applicable to this situation, wouldn't it? So he's a selfish, demanding, evil man who seems to be like a spoiled brat as well, because he talks to his father in such a way that his dad is just a means for getting what he wants anyway. There's no respect here for his father. So he's a brash guy. I mean, he doesn't think twice about violating this young woman. He has the audacity then to tell her that he loves her, and he has the disrespectful attitude to demand that his father gets her for a wife for him. Everything is all about him. just to point out, later, when Shechem and his dad are going to go to negotiate to get her as a wife, you're going to see there is zero apology in the discussions that happen. So Hamor and Shechem have, they don't see this as being a big deal, what just happened. Or if they do, they don't see it as something that they ought to be sorry of and repentant over. They'd rather just kind of sweep it under the rug and move on. Okay? And so they see it as an opportunity to make an economic treaty later on. So the culture of Canaan is one of wickedness, and we see there is no moral compass within this culture. Evil violence is really what we see, that the people are okay with that. At least they're unwilling to do anything about it. So the question is going to be, how is Jacob going to respond? And really, we're going to see Jacob doesn't do much of a response here at all. We see his sons are going to be the ones to respond. So let's look at the next section, deceptive negotiations. They're going to have some negotiations here, beginning in verse 5. Now Jacob heard that he, referring to Shechem, had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came, and Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they heard of it, and the men were indignant and very angry because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. So Jacob hears it. Jacob doesn't do anything. Now, you might think, well, maybe he just doesn't want to respond rashly. That's why he doesn't do anything right out of the gate. I mean, I think that could be, that would have been a perhaps a wise thing. Just responding rashly is not necessarily wise. But as you read the rest of the narrative, he continues to do what he's doing here, nothing, status quo, okay? So how does Jacob respond? He does nothing. That's basically what happens. Jacob, the patriarch of the family, the one who should be protecting his daughter, does not really respond. He doesn't do anything. The problem, we don't know why. Why does he not do anything? I think it's probably he fears man. He fears what their response might be. He knows he's outnumbered, so maybe there's a practical side of that fear. It could also just be he doesn't really care too much about Dinah. He's like, you know what? She's somewhat expendable, and so rather than start perhaps an all-out war, I ought to not really do too much in this situation. Who knows? We don't know exactly. I will say the fear thing, where I get that from, is at the very end of this passage. Something else, you know, when his children attack this city, his response basically is all about how he's fearful that it's going to cause harm to him down the road. Okay, so he definitely has this fear, and we saw the fear thing with Esau earlier. Which again, did he have a good reason to be fearful? He did. I mean, it looked like he was about to get what was coming to him, but God shows mercy and continues to preserve his promises. Doesn't let him get wiped out. So his sons are angry, right? They're indignant. They're very angry. They call this thing an outrageous thing that must not be done. So we're getting these phrases piled up to show they are grieving and angry over the situation, right? And so what happens when you have a passive leader and then you have a angry mob that thinks they're right, and they are right to be angry, let's just put it that way. What happens? We're about to find out, okay? It's about to be a little bit of an explosive situation here. So they're going to enter into some peace treaty talks, though, first. Here's what Hamor and Shechem's request is, beginning in verse 8. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife." So no reference to what instigated this need for this conversation at the beginning at all, right? No moral compass here. "Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it and get property in it." So this is the leader of this city. He's using the situation to negotiate an economic deal, is what he sees this as, okay? And then his son, Shechem, the one who raped Dinah, he jumps in. As brash as he is, he jumps in the middle of these men talking, and he said to her father and to her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes." Yeah, okay. "And whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife." So Shechem's response, he just again jumps in the middle of things and he just blurts out, "What do I need to pay for Dinah?" That's basically what he says. Now the law later will give things that should happen if someone rapes someone. It gives certain things that have to happen, okay? So you could look at it that way, but really I think what he's doing here is he's basically saying, "What do I have to do to get her? Just name your price and let's just move on with it because I want her as my wife." You know, it's like just, you know, the really wealthy guy ripping out his checkbook to try to write off, deal with the issue and move on with life to get what he wants. You just tell me what I owe you, right? And basically he's treating her like a prostitute, right? How much do I have to pay to have her on my payroll? And we're gonna see at the very end, the brothers bring that up too. They say, "Well, he treated our sister like a prostitute. Is that okay, Dad? Is that what you think, Jacob? It's okay to let him do this?" That's how it's going to end. So one other thing I have to note here. We're not told at this point, but we're going to be told in verse 26 where Dinah is located during this negotiation. And she is not at home. She is still in Shechem's house. So these are negotiations, but who has all the power in the negotiation right now? Shechem has all the power, and he kind of knows that. He has Dinah. They have a whole city of people, right? So that's where it is right now. So in some sense, we're going to see that Jacob's sons answer deceitfully. Perhaps we can in some sense understand that, but we will see that they go way over, and the vengeance that they take is not just either, okay? So here's what happens then. In verse 13, the sons of Jacob will make a deceitful promise here. Verse 13, the sons of Jacob answered Shechem. So again, where's Jacob? Jacob's not talking. His sons are the ones who are going to start negotiating here. They answered his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to him, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone." So verse 17, maybe a veiled threat there. If you won't agree to this one thing, then it's just no deal. And we're going to have some conflict. We're going to have some armed conflict here. That's the way diplomacy tends to work, I think, right? It's like they don't necessarily always come straight out and say things. Sometimes on Twitter that happens with some leaders, but maybe not always, right? So there's this veiled threats, things like that. But we're told, okay, so are they being completely forthright in what they're saying here? They're not. And really the only way you know that at this point is because the author tells you. They answered deceitfully. Now, we don't know exactly yet what the deceit is, but we know. So you ought to be clued in. When you see the crazy stuff that's going to happen, you ought to be like, oh, okay, well, I didn't really expect that, but I knew something was, I shouldn't be completely surprised by that. So we're forewarned. So there's something more than meets the eye here. So what's the reason they give that they can't do the intermarriage stuff right now? They're not circumcised. And what is circumcision? Hold on, back up. What role does it play? How has that come up in Genesis earlier? How has that issue been brought to the forefront? Yes, a sign of the covenant that God had made with Abraham and his descendants, right? They're taking the sign of the covenant, and they're basically saying, look, if you want to be one with us, there's a religious issue we have here, right? The God that we worship says for us to be his people, we have this sign that represents we belong to him. And if we're going to intermingle, you're going to have to partake of that sign too. Okay, that's what they're saying, which does make what they end up doing later all the more audacious, because they basically took the sign that God had given and they use it in a deceitful way to trick these guys. So that's not cool. But they give this reason. So to them, it's like, oh, no, it's not about money. It's about our religion, which, again, I mean, they're right to say they can't intermingle with people that are not following the one true God. But it's more than just a sign of circumcision, because you have Israelites that are circumcised later that do not know God. So it's kind of the way unbelieving people use religion, or they use Christianity, right? They're doing the same thing here. I don't think his sons are probably believers at this point. And so they're doing what good people do, right? You take Christianity, I say good in quotes, right? You take Christianity and it's a way to get ahead, or it's a way to get people to do what you want. I've seen this happen with people, even in my family, that claim they'll claim to be a Christian, and it just gets used to make things look better when they're trying to make some sort of deal or something with someone. So they use this reasoning. And then what do Hamor and Shechem do? Well, they agree in verse 18 that they say the words please Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem. Okay. So now what we're going to see, though, is perhaps Hamor and Shechem were also doing the same thing that often happens in diplomacy, which is both sides don't actually mean exactly what they're saying to one another. Okay? So they answer deceitfully. Let's see. I'm going to read this, and I want you to listen and tell me. I'm going to ask after I'm done reading it, what is different in what Hamor says here versus what he said earlier when he was talking to Jacob and his sons, okay? So here they're going to go talk to the people of their city. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house. So Hamor and his son Shechem, now remember, they're basically the ruling family of this city, we were told earlier, came to the gate of the city. So that's kind of like city hall. They bring all the people together, or the city square perhaps, and spoke to the men of the city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men agree." So it's kind of like, oh, by the way, there's one little catch to this whole thing. "To dwell with us and become one people. When every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us, and all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem. And every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Okay, so what's the little tidbit that we get told here that he didn't mention to Jacob? Yeah. Yeah, so you can dwell, you can trade, and all your stuff's going to be ours, right? We're going to end up with all your stuff as you continue to intermingle with us and you settle in here. It's all going to be ours. And we're not told how it's going to be. I mean, is it like their version of eminent domain? Is it just we have more people than them, so as we continue to marry, like our families are going to be the ones that have ownership of everything? We don't know. But the point is, he throws that in there. Now, some of this could also be, you know, I mean, he just got done saying, oh yeah, there's one catch. All of you have to get circumcised. But, and then he quickly kind of adds this, but we're going to be really wealthy, guys. This is a financial thing going on here, right? So could that's part of what's happening too, as he gives his reasoning here. But again, what instigated all this too? We have to also ask that question. His son, his bratty, selfish, violent son, wants this woman because he sees her as an object to be had. I want this object. I want this woman. There's no mention of that in this talk, is there? John Calvin says this. I thought it was interesting. It's so based on those two things I just said about some of this deceit, he says, it's a very common disease that men of rank, so people in this type of leadership who have great authority, while making all things subservient to their own private ends, feign themselves, pretend to be considerate for the common good, and pretend a desire for public advantage. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, you can be in politics and not be, I think there are Christians who are in politics, okay? And I think there are probably unbelievers in politics too, by common grace, who are not this way. I think that's true, right? We have to be honest about those things. But it is, you know, even in Calvin's day, he could see that oftentimes people in power on the outside, everything's about the public good, when really a lot of what's going on is what's going to benefit their own private interest. So we need more Christians in politics in one sense. I mean, we don't need them in the sense that, like, we're going to bring in the kingdom. I mean, Jesus is coming back. He's going to do a fine job of that. He doesn't need our help in bringing back his kingdom. But as much as we try to do good to our neighbors and love our neighbors, it's good to have Christians in politics who say what they mean and do what honors God and what's good for their neighbor, regardless of how it affects them individually, right? I mean, how great would that be to have people leading like that? But the point is here, Jacob and his sons, as well as Shechem and his dad and all them, are being deceitful in what they're doing. So Jacob must have had a lot of possessions because the guys in the town agreed to it. So you can see there's these negotiations. They look polite on the surface, but everyone's lying through their teeth. Jacob is deceitful. Jacob's sons, Hamor is deceitful, and his son. And then Dinah is being held hostage basically during all of this. Now, let's see what Jacob's sons end up doing. On the third day, this is verse 25, on the third day when they were sore, so after all the men had been circumcised, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field, and all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses they captured and plundered. So Simeon and Levi massacre the men of Shechem. That's what happens, right? I think they probably had their household servants who probably helped them. They probably weren't completely alone in this thing. But it was a very egregious thing to happen, right? These men are at a disadvantage. They feel secure, and they end up wiping them all out, which again, in one sense, they're all somewhat probably complicit, because it doesn't seem like the whole culture there really cares about sexual violence. And yet at the same time, I think we can all see pretty clearly Shechem is the offender here, right? Not every single person to the same extent that Shechem is. And yet they treat all these men the exact same way, murdering them all. and just to be clear, you know, we all deserve God's justice, and all of us deserve judgment. And if you're a Christian, Jesus took that for you. So justice is still satisfied. If you're a Christian, it's not like God is unjust in forgiving you. Justice happens. Jesus took it for you. But the Israelite, and God can command his people, the Israelites, to take this land later, but he hasn't done that now. And so what they're doing is completely outside of what God would want them to do. They are just acting on their own zealous sense of vengeance. Later, Jacob, when he blesses his sons before he dies, this is what he says, just to show you that he sees them as being very unnecessarily violent. He blesses his sons, and for Simeon and Levi, this is what he says. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company, for in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. So we get this idea that they are just cruel in what they do here, okay? What do the other brothers do, though? Are they better in some sense? Not really. I mean, they plunder the city, right? So they go in and they plunder the city. So basically, you have a war zone here. That's basically what you have happening. You have a war zone that is unfolded. And what we're going to see is that we have a potential war on the horizon. And that's what brings us to the next thing. Evil, deception, and violence will not stop God's promises. Let me read to you this last portion, and you tell me what Jacob's main worry and concern is, okay? Verse 30. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they, Simeon and Levi, said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" Okay, so what's Jacob's concern? Is it Dinah? What was it? Me, yeah. Me, my, right? He's very concerned about himself, his own skin. And in one sense, he's justified because he is right. I mean, he's very outnumbered. So the fear is right in the sense that your sons put you in a really bad situation. But again, he hasn't really been doing a great job trusting God. And so again, even as a believer at this point, I think he is a believer, sin is still abounding, right? We need God's grace. And yet you still just see this self-centeredness in his response, I think. So what's going to end up happening? Well, the big deal here is, yes, he might get wiped out, and the promises that God has made, what will happen to them? Because God's promised this salvation that he's been talking about is going to come through this offspring, and it's going to be now, we know, through Jacob and his descendants. What happens if Jacob and his descendants get wiped out? So the promises, humanly speaking, again, this happens over and over again in Genesis. They look like they're on this precipice about to fall over a cliff. And God always comes through to show that he is the one who not only made the promises, but who will bring them to pass. So God's going to get the glory at the end of the day for doing what he promises. And so we see that that's what's going to happen. I'm going to read a little bit ahead here just to show us that. Genesis 35, verse 1. So this is what we're going to see next week. God said to Jacob, "Arise and go to Bethel and dwell there." Have we seen that place before? Several times. If you pay attention earlier, remember that? Okay. So God tells him, you need to go there. "Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." Skip down to verse 5. So he's supposed to go there. "And as they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came to Luz," that is Bethel, "which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And there he built an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother." So who preserves his promises? God does, right? God. So Jacob was right. He should fear that the people in this land are going to say, you know what, these outsiders have come into our territory and they are not trustworthy, they're dangerous, we need to deal with them. But who preserves them? God makes a terror fall on these people so that they do not go and attack him as he goes back to Bethel, where God had said earlier, "I will bring you back to this place. I will be with you and I will bring you back here." And you know what? It's not because Jacob is such a great guy and his sons are such great guys. They really made a big mess of things by their sin. And yet God in his grace is accomplishing his promises. So as Christians, we can take comfort in that too, right? God has promised us what? He will never leave us or forsake us. We will safely enter his kingdom. Paul says that when he's about to be martyred. He says, you know what? I've been through all these trials. God preserves me, and he's going to safely bring me into his kingdom. Paul's about to die. So that doesn't mean he's not going to let you die. It just means you'll enter his kingdom safely, right? So God makes these promises, and he keeps them. Let's end with a quote by this commentator, because I thought it was a helpful summary of what I'm trying to say here. He says, it's on your handout, by the way, if you want to read along. He says, here, on the verge of the total fulfillment of the promise of his and his vow, Canaanite lust, so Shechem and his crew, his own cowardice, that's talking about Jacob, his son's folly, all combined to destroy the prospect of Jacob's return to his father's house in peace. Yet he does make it. As often in Genesis, the invincibility of the promises is once again demonstrated. Divine grace triumphs despite human sin. So that ought to be our encouragement, right? That's the lesson, I think, of this passage. We've come full circle. Jacob had been in Bethel. God said, I'm going to bring you back here. Now he comes back, I think, a changed man. I think God has saved him. He's still a sinful human being. He still sins in terrible ways, and yet God is continuing to do his promises, to bring them to pass. So through many dangers, toils, and snares, God's grace triumphs, doesn't it? And that's what you see happening here. Well, are there any thoughts or questions as we come to an end of chapter 34 here? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, that's right. Yep. So you have Simeon and Levi, so the two sons who really carry out the massacre, and Levi is going to be the tribe through whom the priestly line is going to be, right? Yeah. So again, God's redemptive in the way he's going to do these things. That's right. Sure, yep. Right. Yeah, so he's going to preserve the offspring here that he had promised, right, through any sort of keeping them from intermingling, intermarriage, things like that, that would have taken them away from the living God. Because remember, Israel, they're in a different situation. They are the physical tribe and people through whom the Messiah, Jesus, is going to come. The promises are given to, right? So they're in a different testament than we are. So that's significant, this intermarriage thing. Yeah. And for us, it kind of gets played out as Christians in that we're not to intermingle and marry with unbelievers. Now, there are believers who are married to unbelievers. That's a legitimate marriage. They're, you know, you're not sinning by remaining in that marriage. Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 7, I think. So anyway, maybe I'm getting into a whole other topic. But other thoughts, questions? I don't think it says about her being conceiving from the attack. I don't know if Dinah is mentioned again. Does anyone know? I don't think she is, but maybe she is. Yeah, so.
Because Genesis 34:29 is the last mention.
Okay. So Jeff's saying that if you look up the word Dinah, I think that's the last mention of her. Is that what we just read? Yeah. Yes? Yeah.
How were they?
Right.
Powerless were they against these people?
Yeah.
Actually, they're not.
Right. So, yeah, so what would the right response be? So I think that's helpful. I mean, I think that is helpful to point out that murdering the entire city of men was not the right response. I think that's true. They're at a disadvantage in that they have Dinah, right? It's not like they can just take her and run. What are they supposed to do? I would think, having been told of the promises, that what Jacob should have done was confront Shechem and his dad when they came to do this and say, wait a second, you're not even mentioning what you did to my daughter. Let's talk about that. And then second of all, we need to try to make things as right as we can, and then we're going to see you guys later, and then leave. Now, does that mean that they say, okay, you can have her back? Maybe not. But that's where I think where the faith probably would have came in, that, okay, if we have to go to war with these people, we're going to do it legitimately, and the Lord will be on our side. I don't know. That's a good question. What would the right response be? Because I don't think it would have been just to ignore it and leave Dinah there and be like, well, I guess we lost her. See y'all later. You want to see some sort of justice. But, we're also reminded, too, that justice is never going to be perfect this side of heaven. I mean, think about how many people get off with things. And so for the Christian living after the time of Jesus, we leave vengeance to the Lord. That doesn't mean we don't seek whatever sort of reparations, I don't know what word I'm trying to say there. We don't seek that the government does what they ought to do, but there are Christians who live in governments where that doesn't happen, right? So what are they to do? Well, after the time of Jesus, we know we have this forgiving attitude that we turn out. But even there, would we just leave our sister in enemy hands? No, I think we'd still try to go get her. So yeah, that's a good question. Sticky, yeah. Sure. Right, so Yeah, so it seems like Jacob shouldn't have even really been in this area, right? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yep. Right, yeah. So, and he just settled, right, he settled in the wrong spot where God told him not to go. Yep. Yep, I think you're right. Sure.
They didn't, like, sneak up on him in their beds and kill him. They were just
sure.
At a disadvantage.
Yep. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that view.
I don't know if they were murdered or not.
Yeah.
They were attacked.
Sure. Yeah.
So
yeah, so that's another view is, you know, maybe we shouldn't be calling this murder. Maybe they did fight back, right? And they were at a disadvantage, and perhaps this was some of the, you know, in war, there's a sense in which we do deceive other nations. We don't tell them, here's where we're going, here's what we're doing, and I think that's legitimate, which I think it's a little different in that they used the sign of circumcision. I think that's still a big deal. They shouldn't have used the sign of circumcision in doing that. So there, somehow there's a lack of faith there, but I think that could be a legitimate view that you're bringing up there. So, yeah, last one, then we close up.
Powerful.
Sure.
Family of the
government. Yep.
And they were to get her back.
Yep.
The only way to do it was the way they did it.
Yep.
You know, it
right. Yep. I'm sympathetic to that view. Yeah.
It was tough.
Yeah.
But
right.
There was no way to go ask for her back.
Sure. Yep. Right. Yeah. Right. Yep.
And had her captive in the house.
Yep.
It was hard, but it was fair.
Sure. Yep. So I'm sympathetic to that view. All right. Well, let's close in prayer, and then we'll be done. God, thank you for your word. Thank you for the time to think about it together. God, we're thankful that your promises do come to pass. They have come to pass. That nothing will thwart those, whether it's human sin, whether it's foolishness, whether it's powers that of other people that would infringe on or look to infringe on what you've promised. Yet you are faithful, you are powerful, you are the sovereign God who brings about all your purposes. So we thank you for that, and we look forward to worshiping you this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.